James 5:1 through 5:11, the 14th talk in a series on James, was presented by Ron Julian on January 17, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last time I was here teaching, I was just coming to the end of a series on James, but we're going to finish in James. You all remember, of course, what I said before in James, so I won't need to go over that. Actually, what I thought I would do, just to get us oriented to what's going on in James, I'd like to step back and speak in very general terms about the theology that's underlying James, rather than going into specific interpretive issues that we looked at. James is a letter about living out our faith. And from my perspective, there are two very important perspectives on faith that are shared, as far as I can tell, by all the biblical authors. And certainly James is coming from this place. First of all, the first thing about faith is that faith is a matter of the will. And what I mean by that is that we human beings believe what we want to believe to a certain extent. What we believe is affected by what we are willing to know. There are times when the evidence ought to lead us to believe something, but we won't do it. We don't like the implications of that particular piece of knowledge, and so we push it aside and pretend that it's not true. That's why the Bible emphasizes the idea of faith, of responding to the story of the gospel by believing it, because to not believe it arises out of a willful rejection of things that we don't want to know. That story strikes hard at the root of our deep-seated selfishness. It tells us that we are not the center of the universe, even though we would like to be the center of the universe. That story requires us to make room in the universe for God and for each other and for the truth about ourselves. It means that we have to admit that we're guilty and need forgiveness. And these are things that, by nature, we do not want to do. So that's why the idea of faith in the Bible is so emphasized. It really requires a huge exercise of the will. It involves bending the knee to God and the truth, saying, I don't want it to be true, but I will acknowledge that it's true. The second thing that's important to understand about faith, from a biblical perspective, is what we believe is reflected in our lives. The way we live has something to do with what we believe to be true. And this is a common sense observation. If I'm sick and I want to get well, and you come to me and say, hey, I've got this great medicine that I found. This will cure you. And I say, oh, thanks. Yeah, I believe that. That's great. Thanks for this medicine. I'm sure you're right. And then I don't take it. You have a right to ask the question as to whether when I said I believe you when you made these great claims for the medicine, whether I actually believe it or not. If in fact I don't take it, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I take it if I believe you that it's going to solve my problem and I really want my problem solved? So my actions suggest that what I say I believe is in fact not what I believe for one reason or another. And it's this common sense reality that is behind the New Testament concept of the testing of our faith. God is going to put us in situations where we will have to act on what we say we believe. Our beliefs may be genuine, but they're going to have to ultimately come out in the midst of life. Going through these trials accomplishes two things. First of all, it reveals ourselves to ourselves. We discover what sort of people we are, whether in fact we believe what we say we believe, which is a good thing. And furthermore, it causes us, this testing process, causes us to mature in our faith. That is, our beliefs after we have had to act on them and decide whether they are really ours and what we're going to do about them, our beliefs become more integrated into the way we live our lives, so that they actually become more fundamental part of how we think about the life that we live. So, I see the Bible and James having these two perspectives about faith. Each of us must choose whether we will accept the hard truths about God and about ourselves, and each of us will be called upon to act on those beliefs in life, to confirm them and strengthen them. Now, in one sense, we might say then that this is the great theme of James. I mean, James is all about the testing of our faith, the living out of our faith, the idea that faith has to work. It has to actually make its way into life. Any of you who have read James know that that's the big part of what it is that James is talking about. I do want to say that in a broader sense, this is the theme of every book in the New Testament, I would say. The idea that we are called upon to confront the truth, believe it, and then act in a way, live in a way that is in keeping with what we believe. What changes from book to book is the particular issues being addressed. Sometimes James is pitted against Paul. Paul is the one who is arguing for our rightness before God being not on the basis of works of the law, but on the basis of faith. And here's James coming along and saying, well, but faith without works is dead. But as I've argued before, they're not saying different things at all. They are just dealing with different issues. Paul in Galatians, for example, is dealing with the problem of legalism. So the particular belief that is being tested among that group of Christians is the belief that they are unworthy sinners. So do they think that they are worthy of salvation because they keep the rules? Or will they admit that only the mercy of God is going to save them from the destruction that they deserve? So the Galatians are in a situation where what they do, how they act, the things that they impose on each other and so on, are a reflection of what it is they really believe, which is in tension with the gospel that has been proclaimed. James is not dealing with the problem of legalism, at least not much. There are a number of themes that James deals with, but I think you could sort of sum up the great problem that James is addressing as being worldliness. Do I believe that this world, with its riches and pleasures, can give me what I truly need? Or will I accept that this world is going to fail me? In the end, this is not going to solve my problem. Whatever deal I can work here is not going to last, and it's not going to do the job. And that true life ultimately is found in the kingdom of God, in eternal life, an eternal life of righteousness in the kingdom of God. That's the part of the gospel story. That's the part of the set of beliefs that make up the gospel that is being tested in the people that James is writing to. And the letter goes in a variety of directions and talks about a number of different things, but there are two sort of major issues, things that take up a great deal of space in James, that are related to this problem of worldliness. First of all, many in the church are suffering persecution at the hands of rich believers. And this is really confronting them with the question of, what is my real problem and what's going to solve it? This is an opportunity for them to remember that the true riches are found in the kingdom of God. That rich unbeliever who is oppressing them is going to lose it all. He cannot keep it. In the end, the one who has put his trust in God will rise, will prevail, will live, will triumph. And the one who seems to have everything now is going to fall. That's what the faith would tell us. That's what the story of the gospel tells us. Likewise, that believer who has come in among you who is dirt poor and has nothing to provide of a material nature or social nature, nothing to give you. He can't give you a place in society. He can't help solve your problem. He can't get the rich people to stop beating you up. The fact is, that poor believer is the rich one. He's the one who has the eternal riches. He has the riches that will not fade. In the end, he is the one who will prosper. He is the one who will have everything. He's the one you ought to want to be like. But what has happened among the churches that James is writing to, many people have responded to this situation instead by lusting after wealth, by sucking up to rich people, and by treating poor people with contempt because, hey, they don't have anything to give me. In other words, they are acting as if the gospel is not true, as if the promise of life and true wealth in the gospel is a fairy tale that I can't really take into account when I'm dealing with real life situations. The other major issue that we see in James is the issue of the tongue, the way we talk to one another. People are lusting to be in positions of power, to be teachers and leaders in the church. They're driven by jealousy and selfish ambition, seeking to triumph over their competition. They see each other as competitors for the power and prestige and the position that is available. And so in their competition, they are speaking against each other, fighting each other, even killing each other, James says. But basically, their tongues are giving them away. What they say, how they speak to each other and about each other, is showing what their values are ultimately, what they really believe. What they're doing is they're quarrelsome, they're contentious and greedy. The desire for power in this world has caused them to abuse the very people who should be their brothers and sisters. Okay, so the testing of our faith in life, the question of wealth, and the question of how we speak to and about each other, what it is we're looking for ultimately in that, those are the themes that we have been seeing in James. So we come now to chapter 4, verse 11 of James. That's where we left off last time. And we're basically finishing up with a couple of verses here what James was saying about the tongue and how we speak to one another. And he's coming at it from a little different angle here this time. So in James 4, 11, "Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor?" Okay, so what's he saying here? First of all, let's talk about this phrase, "do not speak against one another." Sometimes this word is translated as slander, "do not slander one another," which is all right, except it's a little bit misleading. We tend to associate the idea of slander with the idea of saying something bad about someone that's not true. I'm going around saying that you're an adulterer when you're not really an adulterer, and so I'm slandering you by saying that something is true of you that is not. That's not at stake here. That's not what James is getting at. The truth of the statements is not the issue. What we're talking about is saying bad things about people, going around and talking other people down, whether it's true or not. And quite likely, in fact, it might be true. It might be a situation where the person has done the thing that you're saying they've done. Notice how he pairs it with the idea of judging. He who speaks against a brother or judges a brother. So the issue is not lying about a brother. The issue is judging someone and going out and talking about them. To judge in this sense is to condemn. From my lofty perch of superiority, I have decided that you are worthy of condemnation. But judging is something that I can just do inside. I can just loftily decide that I'm better than you are, and I don't have to go around talking about it. But James here is talking about marrying that attitude with action, that I'm actually going around and condemning you to other people. I am talking you down. I am announcing your faults and trying you in the court of public opinion. I think that's the thing that James is talking about. Now, the next question is then, What does James mean when he says, the one who judges his brother judges the law? What is he getting at there? Does he have anything specific in mind? I mean, it has been argued, and we could just see it as law in general. I mean, we certainly have the law of love from Jesus, that we are to love one another. Jesus tells us not to judge. And we could just see the law as in general, you know, God's principles of goodness. And we know that we're not supposed to judge, so we're violating that. And that's possible. But what's striking to me is that I think that James actually has something a little bit more specific in mind. I'm sure you don't remember at this point, but earlier in James, I argued that there is a place where James is specifically referring back to Leviticus chapter 19. There are several verses in Leviticus 19 that really capture what it is we are obligated to do in our relationships to each other. And in that section, his argument, I think, depended on actually going back and looking and seeing what it is that Leviticus had said. I'm inclined to think that he's doing it again here, this very same passage, when he talks about the law and how we ought to deal with each other based on the law. I think he's referring again to Leviticus 19. So let me read you that. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to. This is Leviticus 19:15. Let me read you the section, and then I'll tell you what I'm thinking. In Leviticus it says, "You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Okay, so notice the specifics here in this section. The Israelites were not to go about as a slanderer. And again, I don't think that lying about someone is the issue. As I understand this word, it's being a talebearer. It's related to a word that talks about being a peddler. You go out and you're peddling your wares. You're a trader going out and trying to sell. But the idea here is that now I'm basically a talebearer. I'm going out and I'm taking stories about you around and peddling them to everyone, as I understand it. Notice that in the section, it is okay to point out fault. He says, "You may surely reprove your neighbor." There is nothing wrong with seeing that your neighbor has done wrong and encouraging him not to do the wrong that he is doing. "But I am not to seek his harm. Just because he is doing wrong, I am not to act against him. I am not allowed to slander him, to act against his life, to incur sin because of him, to take vengeance or bear a grudge." I mean, all of those things together are basically ways of describing how we might respond to someone who is in the wrong. And yet, we're not to bear a grudge. We're not to take vengeance. We're not to slander them. Instead, we are to be guided by what Jesus calls one of the two great commandments. And this is where this commandment is found in the Old Testament. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." That is, I am to think about the welfare of my neighbor as I would think about my own welfare. I am to picture myself in that situation and treat my neighbor as I would want to be treated. So, if I were in the wrong, what would I want someone else to do? Would I want them to slander me and take vengeance against me and to seek my life and to bear a grudge against me? No. If I would want them to come to me and talk to me about it rather than seeking my harm in that way. So it seems to me that this passage in Leviticus is speaking exactly to the issue that James is addressing here. How am I supposed to deal with someone I don't like, someone that I think is in the wrong? And in particular, how am I supposed to talk about them? And Leviticus specifically says, I am not to be a slanderer and I am not to seek their harm. So it may not be, but I'm inclined to think that when James says that we're speaking against the law, that he actually has something that specific in mind. That in being a slanderer, in being one who is going around and talking down people who I think are in the wrong, there is this great hypocrisy involved in it. I mean, we all know that when we go around talking other people down, there is this subtext to that, which is my own virtue. I mean, that's what we're really talking about, is I'm not like that. I mean, and maybe you and I together can agree, we sure are glad that we're not like that. So whenever you're cutting someone else down in that way, there's always this idea that I am a champion of what's right. You know, I hate to have to be saying this, but, you know, I am, after all, someone who believes in the law and what you're supposed to do, and unfortunately this person is messing up, so I have to tell you about it. But that's what I think James is getting at. He's saying, when you are speaking against one another, you are speaking against the law, which tells you not to speak against one another. You're presenting yourself as a doer of the law, as a champion of good, when in fact, in the very process of presenting yourself as a champion of good, you're showing that you are a rebel against what God has really called us to. So I think Leviticus specifically, and then certainly the overall principles of the law and what we see further in the teaching of Jesus and so on, we see that what is right, God's principles, God's way of looking at life, calls me to humility and love. I am not better than my brother or more important than my brother. True goodness calls me to treat him the way I would want to be treated myself. And to not be doing that exposes a basic hypocrisy, that I'm presenting myself as caring about what is right when in fact I do not. James finishes up by speaking again to the issue of humility. There is one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor? To go about condemning someone to others is to put myself in a place I don't belong. It's like, you know, you and me, God, we know how messed up that guy is. But I'm on the wrong side of the line in that picture. God is the one who is the judge, and both my neighbor and myself are standing before him. My neighbor will be saved or will be destroyed by God, his judge. And the same thing is true for me. I will be saved or I will be destroyed by my judge. But I am not the judge. To be a talebearer and one who condemns people to others is to deny my own need for God's mercy. It is to live as if the gospel were not true. It's to put myself in a place I don't belong. Now, there's a qualification I want to make, and probably most of you already know what I'm going to say here. Whenever we talk about the commandments not to judge, it's important to make this qualification. We saw it in Leviticus, where it says, you may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. If I see one neighbor steal from another, I can't congratulate myself for sitting back and saying, well, I'm not going to judge him. And the fact is that there is an appropriate response. The Old Testament, Jesus, and the apostles all agreed on this. They're all united in saying that it is appropriate to call a spade, to actually respond to evil and say, that's evil. And to say something to people who are involved in doing something that they shouldn't. The emphasis typically, though, is on restoration. Notice in the Leviticus passage, what I am not doing is seeking the harm of the one who is doing wrong. I can reprove him, but not to seek his harm. Jesus portrays the same sort of thing. You start in private. Someone who is at fault, you talk to them privately. And it is only if they will not acknowledge the problem and will not repent that the need to bring other people into it may come in. Paul talks about intervening in situations, someone caught in a trespass, the way we need to, with humility, approach them and try to restore them. So the qualification that we need to make here is that when we're told not to judge, that doesn't mean that we're told not to think that evil is evil or not necessarily to do something in response to it. The commandment not to judge is a commandment not to condemn, not to portray myself as superior, not to seek the harm of someone who has done wrong. God is the judge. If there is vengeance to be taken for evil actions in the world, it is His job to do that. My job is to humbly remember who I am and seek the welfare of those who are made in the image of God, just as I hope they would seek my welfare. That's what I am called to do. To condemn, to portray myself as superior, to seek the harm of someone who has done wrong, is to be an unbelieving hypocrite. It's to act as if I myself were not guilty before God. I'm acting as if somehow justice must be served, while all the while conveniently forgetting that justice had better not be served with me or I will perish. I'm acting as if I am a champion of good while denying my obligation to love my neighbor as myself. So, this then is one of the great trials of our faith. When other people are in the wrong, what are we going to do about it? And in particular, in this situation, what am I going to say about them? I think we all recognize that there are times when it is fairly easy to see that we've crossed the line, and there are other times when it is not so easy to see what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. The key, I think, which is often the key in ethical decisions when I'm trying to decide, am I making the right choice here? Am I doing the right thing? The thing to do is to back up and ask the question, am I acting in love? That is, if I were that other person, would I want this to be happening? And again, you have to be careful with that. I have to picture myself as being my best self in that situation. Obviously, if the other person is a thief, you can say, well, if I were a thief, I wouldn't want to be caught. That's not what love your neighbor as yourself is getting at. You have to step back and say, if I were a thief, what would I really need and what would I want someone to do for me? And that, you know what I'm talking about there. It's very easy to dance around what it is we in fact ought to do. Okay, I'd like to finish out the chapter then by looking at the next section, and then I'll make a comment about the whole thing. We're shifting gears here a little bit. We are in verse 13, I think. Come now. Those who say, today or tomorrow, we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow, for you are a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Okay, well, this is a strange little section. It can almost seem sort of trivial, and we need to avoid trivializing it, in fact. I don't think that this is basically an admonition. Every statement about the future that you ever make, you need to tack on, if the Lord wills, to the end of it. That doesn't really solve the problem. I think it is a good thing to say out loud every now and again to acknowledge that, in fact, this is ultimately up to God. But I don't think that James's complaint is, I don't hear if the Lord wills enough on the end of your sentences. You can see what he's concerned with here. He says, but now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. And somehow he is confronting an attitude here that involves an evil sort of boast. So what is that? What is he getting at here? This is how I would understand it right now. The real issue here is my own claim to power and control. I see myself as a person of power and substance. I have decided that I am going to go out and be successful in business, and you watch, I will carry this out. This will happen. Now, I think our problem here is this might seem fairly innocent. I mean, there are a lot of people that I could think of that seem kind of admirable in their determination. I'm going to get in there and I'm going to get this thing done. They're just confident people. They have ability and they know they have ability, and they're confident that they're going to be able to accomplish what they set out to do. And is that really such a bad thing? It doesn't seem like such a bad thing, really. But I think the attitude that James is confronting here is that presumption, basically this claim that I really am hot stuff. I'm boasting about my control of the future. I'm claiming not just that I think I have skills and I'm confident that I can use them, but I really am making a claim to be able to determine what's going to happen. I see myself as the power in the land. I think James' warning here is for believers. It's not surprising that unbelievers, who are the movers and shakers in the world, would not acknowledge their dependence on the will of God. I mean, it's not surprising that such a thing would happen. But for a believer, we cannot claim such ignorance. To proudly assert that we have the future mapped out is to deny a fundamental truth. God is in charge. We can't pay lip service to God on Sunday and then live the rest of the week as if we are the ones who are calling the shots. And I think it's this sort of thing that James is getting at. What he sees in the people that he's writing to is an essential, again, it's a worldliness. It is a discounting of God. It is a presumption that they, in fact, are the ones who are determining the good things that happen in their life. And they're confidently and proudly asserting that they are going to accomplish what they have set out to accomplish. But to be a believer, to know that God ultimately is the one who is in charge, the one who determines this story, I can't take an attitude like that. I can pursue my goals. I can have a personal gratitude that I have the skills that will likely allow me to pull this off. There's nothing wrong with those things. But I can't live as if God were not the ultimate determiner of what is going to happen. This, by the way, is what I think is happening with this final sentence in here, which is very difficult, I think, to know what it's doing. It's where James says, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Now, if that sentence were just by itself, it wouldn't be hard to propose what it is he's saying. It sounds like what he's getting at is the classic sort of this distinction between sins of commission and sins of omission. That is, it's not enough to not do bad things. You have to also do good things. So to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Sounds like he's saying, okay, so, you know, this is one of those deals. It's not just enough to stay away from bad things. You have to actively do what is right. And that's a good idea. That's fine. Maybe that's the emphasis that James has here. The problem is that it doesn't seem to fit real well with what it is he was just talking about. Why that there? I mean, what does that have to do with make sure that you say if God wills when you're talking about what's going on in the future? Some people would propose, well, hey, this is James. There's no coherence in James. Everybody knows that. This just jumps out of the blue. It doesn't have to be tied in with what came before it because it's just, this is James. What do you want? And you're probably aware that I have not taken that approach with James as we've gone through it. I think that it is much more coherent than people give it credit for. And it's not that hard to find most of the time, if you go looking for it. Here, it's a little hard to find. But I'm not ready to give up and say, especially because he starts out saying, therefore, which is one of those words that implies that it has something to do with what it was that he was just talking about. So I'm not happy with that. We could just take the, well, Okay, it's the sins of omission and commission, and he just thought this was a good spot to put it in. Maybe it's just summing up what he's been saying in the whole thing up to now, or a little warning that he wanted to throw in at this spot. That's possible. It's difficult to say at that spot. One proposal for how it fits in was a little different, very intriguing. You can imagine the situation being where I have made my plans. I'm going to go to this city. I'm going to do one thing. But now circumstances have come up where God is calling me to change those plans and do something else. The right thing now, virtue, is calling me over here instead of where I was planning to do. And in that situation, James is saying, well, the one who knows what to, the right thing to do and doesn't do it, to him it is sin. If I don't do what is right because I have already made my plans to do something else. That's not bad. That's an honorable attempt to try to explain how it's connected, I think. As I've been thinking about it, it's not a perfect solution because, at least for me, it doesn't quite fit the picture as I understand the picture that James is painting here. In that proposal, we are imagining me having to decide, am I going to do what I had planned, or am I going to do this new thing that God wants me to do instead? But the situation that James describes seems a little different to me. The question is one of power and control. I am claiming that I have the power to make things happen in the future as I intend, but in fact, I may not even be alive then. And the picture as I see James describing it is the presumption now of thinking of that I've got the future scoped out. So it's not that in the future, I may not be called to make any decision in the future. I may be dead, and which was not a part of my plan that I was setting out. So I'm still in the market for something that would fit the context a little better here. So my best attempt at this spot, and I'm not supremely confident that this is right, but this is what makes sense to me at this point. I see the emphasis in this sentence as focusing on the contrast between knowing and doing. The verb to do is very important in James. He, throughout the letter, is making this contrast between various things and doing. For instance, we should not just be hearers of the word, we should be doers of the word. His famous faith and works is basically saying it is not enough to say you have faith, you must actually do the things that are in keeping with what you believe. So I'm proposing that same contrast is to be found in this verse. Therefore, to the one who knows to do right and does not do it, to him it is sin. To be in the situation where you know and yet you do not do is wrong. And how does that relate to the context that we're talking about here? This is how I would put it together now. Like I say, my best shot at it. For a believer, it is not a trivial matter to arrogantly assert that we have control over the future. We know better. We are in a position to know that we do not have control of the future and that God does. I don't know where things are going to go in the end, but I know that there is a God who does. Therefore, to know that God is in control and that I should acknowledge that, to theoretically believe and acknowledge that God is in fact the sovereign determiner of life, and yet to arrogantly assert that I myself am going to determine my future, that is a sinful thing. It is not trivial, it is sin. It is rebellion against God to know and yet not act on that knowledge. And in this case, it is my knowledge that God is God and yet my refusal to act on that knowledge in the way that I talk about my life. That's how I would put it together right now. I'm open to other suggestions because it's not easy to know exactly how it fits in, I think. Okay, but apart from that hard question there, what we see here is James confronting people again with that question of whether they're going to acknowledge what's really going on. All of us have a tendency to look at life as if somehow we're the ones who are at the center of it, and God is at best peripheral. But Here, James is asking us to bow in a fundamental way, to acknowledge my life is ultimately a story that God is giving me. I am not the main character in my life, even. I am an important character in my life, but there is a storyteller who plays a more important role than I do. Both of the passages that we looked at here this morning involve the issue of playing God. In the first case, the issue is whether I'm going to go around condemning those that I think are in the wrong, whether I'm going to go around cutting them down and speaking against them to others. And James tells us there, if I do that, I have set myself up as the lawgiver and judge. God has made it clear what I am called to. I am called to humbly take my place alongside you all. If you're in the wrong, to treat you in the way that I would want to be treated myself, and to let God be the one who is ultimately going to deal with the problem of justice in an ultimate sense. To take on the task of cutting you down to, before other people is to put myself in the place of God. It's to say, no, in the end, I'm the one who's really determining what's right and wrong here. I have the right to say these things about you because they're true. You did wrong, and that gives me the right to be your judge. Likewise, if I arrogantly proclaim that I've got it scoped out and I am the one that's going to accomplish these great things in my life, I have set myself up ultimately as the one who determines the course of history. It's not an issue of trivially adding if the Lord wills at the end of my sentences. It is living and understanding the idea that there is a God who is the determiner of history, and that God is not me. Both of these issues confront us with a fundamental issue that we all must face. Will I acknowledge that God is God? This is not just a religious question that we talk about on Sunday. This is an issue that I have to decide in the midst of my life. It's not an abstract question. It's not an academic philosophical question. It is a philosophical question, but it is not an academic one. But the fact is that that is the question that I have to confront. This is where everything starts. Is God God? Is God the lawgiver? Is God the judge? Is he the source of mercy and life? Is he the source of destruction and judgment? Is he the one who determines what's going on in the world? How I answer that question is going to determine the way my life goes. And I have to answer that question in the midst of life. I mean, yes, I can, when I hear the story of the gospel and I go forward and I say, I believe this, yes, this is what I embrace as true. It's not that there's nothing meaningful about that. It may be very meaningful. But in the end, that going forward and saying, yes, I believe this, that's a hidden thing. It's hidden inside so deep that I don't even understand myself well enough to know exactly what's going on there. It's as I live my life and I start to see, oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about here. I went forward and said that God is God, but now I'm having to decide, is God God? If God is not God, then none of this really matters. I mean, the stuff that James is talking about is interesting, quaint, but not ultimately meaningful. But if God is indeed God, then I had better bow my knee, because in the end, he will be the judge. He is the lawgiver. He is going to call the shots. It's one of those deals. God is going to win. That's a good thing, by the way. We want him to win. You would all be worse off if I won. In the battle between God and me, you would not like the world that you ended up with if I won. But the fact is, whether you like it or not, God is going to win. And now is the time. Jesus tells a story about a king who has a certain number of soldiers facing a battle with another king who has a lot more soldiers. And he does the prudent thing. He sits down and says, you know, I'm not going to win this battle. I think I had better seek terms of peace now. Because if we go to battle, I'm going to lose big. And Jesus says, you know, there's something prudent about that. That's the right way to think about it. Well, I think that's where we are with God. Ultimately, we would like to see ourselves as being in control. We would like to see ourselves as really the center of the universe. We would like to see ourselves as the ones whose opinions matter. If I am offended by what you've done, then that's what matters. But ultimately, in the end, it is God's opinion about what has happened that's going to matter. And the most important thing that I can do is settle this question for myself, am I God or is God God? Because that's the fork in the road on which everything depends. And I think that's what James is doing over and over again in his letter. He's writing to believers who, or to Christians, to people who have joined the Christian church, and yet whose actions seem to suggest that they haven't really settled this question. They think somehow that there, something else is God, other than God. And there's no percentage in that. You're not going to win that. If you try to take him on, you're going to lose. So what James in both of these situations then is saying ultimately is that I recognize the goodness of God, the power of God, the justice of God, the mercy of God, and that I bow to it. I stop trying to put myself in his place and accept my place alongside you as his creatures who owe him life, owe our lives to him, owe him obedience, owe him gratitude, and take that place without hypocrisy. Okay, well, that's a hard little section to talk about. It gets me quite preachy, but that's what I want to say about that. Next week we'll go into chapter 5. Do any of you have any questions or comments about this section in James?
I was just wondering about a minor thing you said. When James is talking about, you know, you can reprove your neighbor and everything, is he talking about believers? Like believer to believer, or, I mean, I tend to think of, you know, if you see a non-believer doing something wrong, it's hard to even know where to start to talk to them about it, unless they're, you know, stealing or, you know, killing people, because it's like usually they're just playing by a whole different set of rules anyway. So do you think that's what James is saying is?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. As is true with all of my answers to questions, it's complicated. let me try to be really brief. First of all, going back to Leviticus, which I think he is doing, there are two phrases used in Leviticus. My neighbor, and it's my fellow countryman, or something like that, I think is the other thing. So this is the law that Moses is giving to Israel, and it is specifically, I think, addressing the way the Israelites are to deal with each other. Okay? And there is a certain amount of, to that language, neighbor and countrymen, there's a certain sense of you belong to each other. You are a people together, and you owe each other this kind of behavior. Something like that. But that led the Pharisees in trying to narrow in on, so what exactly is it that God's asking us to do? They asked the question, who is my neighbor? And they were trying to say, okay, so maybe a law-abiding Jew, is that my neighbor? But if he's not a law-abiding Jew, then he's not my neighbor and I don't have to treat him well, or certainly I don't have to treat Samaritans well and that kind of stuff. And so we see in Jesus' teaching the parable of the Good Samaritan, takes that and expands it and says, no, you're not understanding. The spirit of this is my neighbor is anyone who is in the same standing before God that I am. That's a Samaritan or a Gentile or anyone. Okay. So the law of love, the love your neighbor as yourself, is a principle that extends to all human beings. I have that obligation to everyone. But James does use the language brother in his section, and I do think that James would add to this picture that he has in mind that it's all the more wrong, it's all the more contemptible that I would be talking against and speaking against those who I am claiming to be, as a believer, that they are my brothers and sisters. So I think he does kind of have that extra little brother and sister aspect to it that he's bringing in. Now, to come to your question, I don't think he's addressing that issue on the question of what is it prudent to say to whom. And I think you're right that there are those places where I might choose to speak to someone who's not a believer differently than I would choose to speak to a believer based on what I think they understand and are able to deal with. But the law of love would guide me in both of those cases. You know, it might be that with the unbeliever that I might have the sort of relationship with them that I could actually say something and hope that this might catch their conscience, that they really might say, you know, you're right about that. Yeah. So I wouldn't necessarily say that I wouldn't say anything to them, but I think you're right. I'm just trying to decide always what's the loving thing to do, which is going to be to a certain extent dependent on who I'm dealing with and what the situation is.
And I think you have to know people pretty well.
Yeah. That's an important qualification you're making there, I think, because we can always, busybodies can always justify their interfering in other people's lives by I'm being loving. And there's more to love than interference. I mean, sometimes interference is love, but it's not always love. And that's something that's important to keep in mind, I think.
One thing that's come to mind, I don't know, maybe kind of out of a context, but when you're talking about whether, you know, you're speaking just to Christians or others, is when Jesus talks about not casting your pearls before swine. Do you think there's any tie that you could put into this, or is it out of context, or oops? I thought it might be a little
difficult. That's a good thing, except I don't think that I think that's what casting your pearls before swine means, but I can't remember what I think casting your pearls before swine means. So I'd have to go back and look at that in context, but I'm trying to remember. I can't remember. That's a difficult one.
I don't think it directly implies. It just kind of came to mind because we have to be careful sometimes what we say to people, and I think a point was well made that they're going by a totally different set of rules.
Like I say, I agree with that idea that I need to take into account who I'm talking to, definitely. I'm thinking, if I remember correctly.
Ron?
Yes, sir.
We talked about that on Thursday morning, if you want our notes on that.
Okay, good, good.
It was the habit of people to consolidate their offerings into one valuable object or to store their wealth, and pearls were frequently used for that. A person would then, instead of throwing coins and coins and coins day after day into the offering or the sacrifice, would lay one valuable object, which they had consolidated that total worth into. Our understanding that someone casting their pearls before swine is instead of laying a sacrifice before God with the expectation that he would accept it and reward you, you're throwing it to the pigs in sort of this foolish gesture of why in the world would you expect them to give you anything in response for this offering?
Yeah, I can go partway with that at least, because as I'm recalling now, the other language that he uses is the language about throwing what is holy to the dogs. I see the emphasis as being on, and that fits with what you're saying about the pearl, the idea of something holy needs to be treated as holy. So this is not a comment about pigs, it's a comment about what is holy and pearls, I think, and what is appropriate to do with them. So, yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, that's good. Okay, what else?
I just wanted to say I appreciate and agree with the section being about I'm not God and how good that is to remember. And I just always want to add to that. I don't know if it's implied in James or if it's just more from our today's point of view, but I'm not God and God doesn't work for me.
Yeah. We are supposed to approach God with confidence because he has proclaimed, I will be merciful and I will bless you if you will repent, if you will acknowledge how far you have gone from me and let me solve the problem. So we're right to see him as the source of what is good, but it's really easy to shift from that dependent, I need to go to God to seek my life, to that seeing God as a tool that I can use to get what I want, that he works for me kind of thing. And it may seem like a subtle difference, but I think you're right. There's a lot of difference between those two things. And it's important to keep that difference.
It was good to piggyback on this last remark, for I would like to comment further on your problem and mine of the concept of not being the center of the universe. It seems easy to me for us not to choose to be the center of the cosmos, the real big picture. But when it comes down to being the center of my experience, Stan Falarski here in the Coburg region, Eugene, Oregon, the Northwest, the things that I'm supposed to be confident and in control of and have good composure and do the right thing, boy, I choose to want to be in charge of those things. The difficulty comes for me down into the personal aspect of it. I don't spend much time worrying about the cosmos.
Yeah, I'm not asking for much. I just want Eugene. Anything else?
I think you would agree, but maybe you could comment. It seems to me that I hear a lot of Christians focus when they hear not talking down, I think is the language used, not talking down other people, that they tend to emphasize the action of sharing information that is of an unflattering nature toward other people. But if I'm understanding you right, that's really not the emphasis. It's not so much what we do as an attitude, an inner attitude that we have, a perception, a belief that we have about ourselves, namely that we're above other people, that we are not subject to the same sin, and so on. And the reason I'm asking is because it seems to me that I have observed and been a part of conversations that were very profitable and very edifying, that involved, in one sense, talking down other people, that is, identifying, the way I would describe it is, identifying the manifestations, some of the subtle manifestations of our sin, of human sin, as we observe it in the life of another person. And I don't know that James would necessarily have a problem with that or would disagree with that, that what makes it evil is, as you put it, when we wish harm, when we wish to put ourselves above them and so on.
Right. No, I don't disagree with what you're saying. And that's why he pairs judging and speaking against. I think those things are going together. It is that condemning that is being acted out in seeking their harm in the way I talk about them with people. So no, that doesn't imply that to say someone else is in the wrong is to judge them, to condemn them, to presume that I am their judge or that I'm seeking their harm or anything like that. So yeah, it's not the act. I can't guard against this by just never talking about anyone or to anyone. That's not going to solve the problem. I think though it is true that he is marrying here. He has been talking about the tongue, and he's talking about that attitude of condemnation and seeking the harm of those that I feel are in the wrong, or may have wronged me, by acting on that in the way that I talk. So talking is in view, but not every kind of talking. It is hurtful, condemning talking. Yeah, and I agree.
My question is with regard to planning for the future. That passage in James always brings to mind five-year plans. Mm-hmm. I'm going to major in this, mm-hmm. Daytimers, that kind of thing. And what I'm wondering is how, you know, what is James addressing in or how does that apply to our modern, you know, kind of this notion that we should always have these type of things and you know, you're somehow not responsible if you don't have a five-year plan or long-term goals and short-range goals, that type of thing.
Well, I don't think that what James is saying really solves our problem there. Here's how I think about it. If I look at Paul, Paul was a man with a mission. He had this knowledge that it is my task to proclaim the gospel and especially to encourage in the faith the people that I have called to the gospel. And he often talks about how, you know, I was planning to do this. I was going to come to you because I wanted to be there and share with you and encourage you in the faith. I wanted to come, but then I couldn't. Or I really want to come and I don't know how I'm going to get there. In Romans, he's really desirous. He hasn't been to Rome. And he wants to get to Rome to be able to teach and encourage the Christian church in Rome. So Paul is a man with plans. He sees things that he thinks are important to do, and he wants to do them, and he's trying to make them happen. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But what you see in Paul is the very thing that James is talking about. You see him saying, but it was not at all God's will that I do that right now, so I'm not. Or I really want to come see you guys, and I'm praying to God that I would be able to come and see you guys, but it's up to God ultimately. And of course, we all know the great irony of Paul's prayer in Romans that he would get to Rome to be able to talk to the Roman church, is the way God pulled that off is having him arrested in Jerusalem and taken to Rome in chains and be arrested there for several years. But he answered his prayer. He got to Rome and got to teach the church there. So planning, having goals, to saying this would be a good thing to do and trying to work to make the thing happen that I think is a good thing to do, I don't see that as being in tension with the kind of thing that James is calling us to. I mean, I would like to think that, for example, at Gutenberg and the things that we're doing, that we're being responsible in thinking about the future, and we talk about five-year plans and that kind of stuff. But I am aware of what I think is a genuine attitude among the people that I work with, that this is a thing that God has done and that we don't have any right to expect that it's going to go on forever. We can't say, we know that this is going to happen this way, because it just may not. I mean, God may have other plans. So I don't think those things have to be in tension. Now, having said that, I think our culture, there are other problems that can enter in with the five-year plan thing and everything, which is the whole, we do get this idea that somehow the unscientifically managed life is not worth living or something like that. And I think we're in the wrong there. I think we have gotten this idea that we can make things happen that we can't really, and control things to more extent. But in principle, I would never say, oh, you know, obviously those are a bunch of unbelievers. Look, they have a five-year plan. I mean, I think a five-year plan can be a faithful thing to do. So you have to look deeper to decide whether something good is going on there or not. It's the way I would look at it. Good time to stop? Okay. Thanks.